Welcome to the Deep Dive. I'm Joe Buckley.
And I'm Sam Lowry.
Today, we are taking on something pretty massive.
A huge project, really.
A comprehensive deep dive into the January 2026 issue of the National Review.
And, you know, if you are looking for that absolute shortcut to being instantly and, frankly, exhaustively informed on the state of conservatism,
the new cultural battle lines, high-stakes geopolitics,
yeah,
all of it, at the start of 2026.
This is where we're going to unpack that core analysis for you.
Yeah, our mission today is to go way beyond just a simple summary.
Right. We are synthesizing the critical analyses and really pulling out the most surprising and sometimes honestly alarming insights from all this material.
And what the magazine really shows us is a political movement that is deep in an identity crisis after some major election losses.
And a terrifying shift in moral reasoning that seems to justify political violence.
On top of that, you've got these critical assessments of America's global standing, from adversaries in Venezuela to, well, very fraught partnerships in India.
We have a lot to cover, and I think we need to start right where the political action and, frankly, the political pain was felt most keenly.
The 2025 election cycle.
Exactly.
So let's just get right into this political reckoning. According to Noah Rothman's pretty devastating postmortem, Tangled Up in Trump, the GOP experienced what he just bluntly calls a drubbing.
A drubbing. I mean, that's not a word you use lightly.
No. And this wasn't just a loss. It looked like a deep blue wave in off-year local elections, which is something the party seemed totally unprepared for.
That's absolutely correct. The source data, it points to these near comprehensive setbacks. And not just in the big marquee races, but down ballot contests in really key suburbs.
So we're talking about massive GOP losses in places like Virginia and New Jersey.
Right, and even notable disappointments in local races in New York City.
Now, the magazine does offer a bit of caution here. It says you shouldn't overinterpret these results.
Well, sure, because Republicans, you know, they always face headwinds in statewide races in places like Virginia and New Jersey, especially with a Republican in the White House.
But Rothman insists that these results, where you saw Democrats performing 10 points or even more above the polling averages,
they should absolutely not be ignored.
Right. This wasn't just some expected structural loss. He's framing it as a voter rebellion.
And the specifics, I mean, they really reveal how severe it was. Take Virginia. The Democratic Party didn't just hold its ground.
No, they expanded their control of the House of Delegates. They ejected 15 Republican incumbents who had just won their seats 2 years before.
And the Democratic gubernatorial candidate, Abigail Spanberger, she won comfortably.
And crucially, her coattails were long enough to pull the Democratic Attorney General candidate, Jay Jones, over the finish line.
Even though Jones was facing that scandal.
Right, with the widely publicized texts where he was fantasizing about political violence against his opponents.
Which just suggests a powerful, unified Democratic turnout that completely overwhelmed the Republican defenses.
And the situation was just as bad, if not worse, up in New Jersey.
The hemorrhaging was severe. The Republican gubernatorial nominee, Jack Ciattarelli, he ran what everyone thought was a really energetic, highly localized campaign.
Focused on state-level stuff, right?
Okay.
Property taxes, infrastructure.
Exactly. He made this concerted effort to decouple the race from national politics. And despite all that, he lost by a staggering margin.
The Democratic winner, Mikey Sherrill, just sailed to victory.
By 13 points. A 13-point margin, which was 10 points higher than her Real Clear Politics average.
Wow.
And that kind of margin, it just helped Democrats sweep everything down ballot. They unseated 5 sitting Republican lawmakers. The suburban revolt was, for all intents and purposes, complete.
And this brings us to the core of the crisis, the central paradox that Rothman meticulously identifies. And this is where it gets really interesting for the future of the conservative movement.
It's the Trump paradox.
Exactly. Donald Trump successfully engineered this massive political realignment. He brought in the Midwestern white working class, obviously, but critically, he attracted this whole new coalition of non-white voters.
Especially working class Hispanics who were really drawn to his anti-establishment populist appeal and his cultural conservatism.
And that shift was widely seen as, you know, permanent.
But the 2025 results just violently challenge that whole assumption.
So Rothman concludes that the electorate reverts to a more familiar shape when Trump's name is not physically on the ballot.
Right. And the reason is pretty simple, if you think about it. those pivotal non-college educated voters, the engine of that new Trump coalition, they just didn't show up.
They stayed home.
They stayed home. These are voters who were generally less engaged in off-year contests anyway, but their apathy in 2025 was just profound enough to cost Republicans critical races they really needed to hold to prove that realignment was durable.
So what's the specific evidence that these voters actually reverted?
I mean, just look at the numbers. Hispanic voters who shifted right for Trump in 2024, they swung heavily, almost violently, back to the Democrats in 2025.
Where did we see that?
Well, in Passaic, New Jersey, Mikey Sherrill defeated Santorelli by 15 points. She won a massive two-thirds of the state's entire Hispanic vote.
That's a huge margin.
It's enormous. And similarly, in Hispanic-dominated places like Manassas Park, Virginia, the Democrats saw a 22-point swing back in their favor.
So it suggests that without the personal loyalty and, you know, the spectacle of Trump himself, the traditional Democratic pull of identity and organization just takes over again.
It reasserts its dominance, yeah. And the problem extends even to those black voters the GOP managed to attract under Trump's banner.
And those numbers are pretty bleak for the GOP's ability to build any kind of post-Trump coalition.
No, they're bleak. While Trump managed to win 15% of black voters in his last presidential run, the highly accomplished African-American GOP gubernatorial candidate in Virginia, Winsome Earl Sears,
she won only 7% of the black vote.
And a truly meager 3% of black women.
So this evidence seems to prove that down-ballot Republican candidates just cannot transfer the president's unique personal appeal to themselves.
The party's brand, independent of the man, is either too damaged or just too generic to motivate that diverse working-class base that Trump activated.
So if the GOP is tethered to Trump's personal brand, and that brand doesn't motivate the necessary turnout when he's not on the ballot, what does that imply for the crucial 2026 midterms?
Rothman's warning is exceptionally stark. I mean, if this turnout pattern shows up again in the 2026 midterms, which, you know, traditionally see lower turnout anyway,
right,
then Republicans should expect deep losses. We could be talking about an outcome that mirrors the 2018 election.
When the Democrats picked up a massive 41 seats in the House.
Exactly. So the ultimate implication is that the Republican Party has to, and I mean rapidly, develop an identity that's independent of Donald Trump.
An identity built on principles, not personality.
An identity built on enduring principles rather than personality, yes, if they hope to survive the next electoral cycle.
And that imperative, that fight for the party's soul, it leads us directly into the ferocious internal warfare the magazine details, specifically this implosion at the Heritage Foundation.
And this is not just some internal beltway gossip.
No, this is a high-stakes proxy fight over what the Republican identity is going to be post-Trump.
The whole controversy is centered on this feud that started when Tucker Carlson interviewed Nick Fuentes.
And if you're not familiar with Fuentes, he is a self-proclaimed racist, an anti-Semite, and a pro-Nazi provocateur. I mean, his views are just beyond the pale.
Oh, absolutely. He's the one who infamously called Vice President J.D. Vance a race traitor who married a Jeet and made light of the Holocaust, saying Hitler was very cool.
And the core issue here wasn't just the interview itself, was it? It was the nature of the platforming.
Exactly. Carlson gave Fuentes a two-hour, nearly uncritical platform with barely any pushback at all.
And when serious conservatives and journalists rightly criticized Carlson for normalizing that kind of extremism, the president of the Heritage Foundation, Kevin Roberts, he stepped in.
And complicated the entire issue.
How so?
Well, Roberts posted this highly charged video defending his close friend Carlson. He dismissed all the critics as a venomous coalition, which, by the way, included a lot of serious conservative writers, intellectuals, and donors.
And that intervention was deeply damaging. The Heritage Foundation has, for so long, stood as this pillar of serious intellectual conservative thought.
It has. Rigorously maintaining boundaries against the fringe. And Roberts' defense of Carlson just blurred all those boundaries and dealt a severe blow to the institution's reputation.
I understand Roberts eventually apologized to his staff, but not publicly, is that right?
That's correct. He addressed the staff at an all-hands meeting, reportedly saying, "I made a mistake and I let you down."
But he stood by his defense of Carlson.
He did. And crucially, he refused the internal calls to take the video down from X.
And that led to some prominent resignations.
Yes, several key policy analysts and fundraising officials left because they felt the intellectual integrity of the institution had been irrevocably compromised.
So what's the ultimate meaning of this conflict for you, the listener?
It represents the most existential question facing the party after that electoral drubbing.
The magazine frames it perfectly, I think. This is an effort to redefine the Republican Party.
Will the future iteration of Magier fully embrace, and I'm quoting here, fascist cosplay and conspiratorial lunacy, using figures like Fuentes as political weapons?
Or will the party establish a serious, principled identity that actually resists the fringes?
And the implication is that Heritage, a central intellectual institution, is currently, well, either facilitating or at least failing to resist the inclusion of those hateful elements in the conservative movement.
Shifting our focus a bit, but staying within this theme of internal conflicts and defining boundaries.
Philip Klein's piece on Senator Ted Cruz.
Right, who has taken on this leadership role in fighting a surge in anti-Semitism, observing that he has seen, quote, more anti-Semitism on the right than I have in my entire life.
And Cruz's position is pretty unique because he is fighting anti-Semitism on both flanks, which very few politicians dare to do.
On the left, he points to the energized progressive left celebrating the election of the socialist Zohran Mamdani in New York City, who is a determined, vocal enemy of Israel.
But at the same time, he's just deluged by hateful anti-Semitic replies on X, where he's routinely accused of being a shill for Israel or being controlled by Israeli masters.
Which just illustrates how difficult it is to maintain a principled stance when both political extremes are embracing these very similar conspiratorial hatreds.
And this, of course, brings him back into direct conflict with Carlson. They've had previous confrontations over foreign policy.
Absolutely. Cruz points out their previous public spat over Iran and Israel, where Carlson mocked Cruz's theological beliefs.
He accused him of having a brain virus for supporting Israel.
And Cruz's counterpoint is so critical here because he clarifies the basis of his support. He says it flows from his faith and from the robust, pragmatic fact that Israel is by far the strongest U.S. ally in the Middle East.
Aligning directly with U.S. national security interests in a region that's vital to global stability.
So he's rejecting this notion that his support is based on some kind of external control or misplaced religious dogma. He says it's based on hard geopolitical reality.
Right. And if Carlson's show is all about free speech and platforming diverse voices, why is his interaction with Fuentes so objectionable to Cruz?
This is the distinction Cruz makes, and it's a philosophical one, and I think extremely important. It's rooted in the principles of free speech and debate.
Cruz agrees that the cure for bad speech is more speech, which means he believes in tough cross-examination.
But his issue with Carlson's Fuentes interview was not simply platforming him.
No, it was that Carlson, who is famous and, you know, skilled for his aggressive, often ruthless cross-examination of mainstream politicians,
instead fawningly gazed at Fuentes,
allowing his hateful, odious views to go entirely unchallenged and unexamined. Cruz argues that a serious public figure has to treat poison like poison, not treated as some kind of curious novelty.
So Cruz sees this as more than just a political squabble.
Oh, he views it as an existential crisis for the conservative movement. He believes that the kind of corrosive conspiratorial poison that Fuentes represents has already destroyed the Democratic Party's ability to hold a coherent moral center.
And his urgent plea is for elected officials and intellectual institutions to actively defeat this poison on the right.
Before it similarly destroys the Republican Party's ability to govern or even function as a principled opposition.
The whole first section really underscores the high moral and political stakes of defining conservatism in the mid-2020s.
It's a powerful summation, the identity of the party, its moral and political boundaries. That is clearly the battleground.
And that struggle over morality, you know, deciding what is acceptable and what is fundamentally destructive, it extends far beyond politics into the very fabric of social life.
Which brings us to a transition that's a bit jarring, but necessary.
The shocking new cultural trend identified by Ty Fortgang, which he calls the new morality.
Indeed. Fortgang's piece delves into what he defines as the new morality, or a chillingly, Luigism.
And the term itself is derived from Luigi Mangione, who allegedly killed a health insurance executive.
And the tragedy here is that Mangione became this cult figure among certain leftists who honored him not because they thought he was innocent,
but because they thought he was absolutely guilty and justified in his violence against a symbol of power.
Let's define Luigism clearly for the listener. What is the core philosophical tenet here?
Luigism is the belief system that violence is a legitimate and often necessary response to the perceived injustices of capitalism.
It reframes individual acts of violence, even murder, as necessary acts of systemic correction.
So if the victim represents the system, then harming them is an act of justice, not a crime.
And the examples Forking cites of this celebratory violence are truly grotesque. They illustrate a profound breakdown in basic human empathy.
They are stomach-churning. I mean, consider the reaction to the murder of the Blackstone executive, Wesley LePatner.
She wasn't just an executive. She was a lay leader at her synagogue and a mother of two.
But instantly, she was condemned and celebrated as an avatar of capitalism.
And when Blackstone posted messages mourning her loss, the replies were immediate, revolting, and gloating. You had users stamping her picture with the meme, Louise E.D.
The celebration was based entirely on her symbolic role, completely stripping her of her individual humanity.
And this philosophical justification, it extended to other high-profile assassinations.
Right, the horrific assassination of the conservative figure Charlie Kirk generated a torrent of similar responses.
Many public figures and social media accounts were indicating that Kirk's murder was acceptable, even good.
They didn't see him as a political opponent or a person with rights. They saw him only as an avatar of conservative revanchism or hate personified.
So once he was reduced to a symbol, his murder became justifiable in the eyes of this new morality.
Which raises this crucial philosophical question. What foundation justifies treating individual people as symbols to be liquidated rather than as individuals with dignity?
And this is where Forking really synthesizes the philosophical shift, which is key to understanding the danger here.
For centuries, Western society was undergirded by biblical morality,
which places desert, that is, guilt or innocence, at the level of the individual.
You are judged by your unique actions and decisions. As the Bible says, each person for his own sin shall die.
And society functions because we agree that individuals have moral agency and are judged accordingly.
But Lewigism, this neo-pagan morality, it sees the world completely differently.
Exactly. It flips this entirely. Neo-pagan morality views individuals not as distinct moral agents created in the image of God, but as mere representations of abstractions, systems of power like wealth or whiteness or conservative ideology.
So under this system, justice is achieved not through individual accountability, but when power is redistributed or when the representative of the wrong deity or system is harmed.
Right. The actions of LePatner or Kirk become completely irrelevant. Their symbolic standing within a detested system is enough to justify violence against them.
This sounds like it poses a fundamental threat to social cohesion itself. Mm-hmm. What are the broader implications for, you know, our listeners' daily life?
Forking warns that this new morality is fatally incompatible with social life.
How so?
Well, consider the practical result. Biblical morality provides a foundation of social certainty. If you go to work, you pay your taxes, you pursue a lawful career, you have a reasonable expectation that you will not be imprisoned or attacked based on what abstract concepts you might symbolize to a radical neighbor.
But if this new morality takes root, social trust just collapses.
If you suspect your neighbor might justify your murder because you represent wealth or a political ideology they detest, you will reasonably choose to cut off social bonds.
Which leads to what sociologists call social atomization.
It erodes the ability to build, to develop, or to invest in a community. Forking stresses that the decline in biblical literacy and the inability to articulate this older morality are making society deeply vulnerable to this bloodlust.
That is an analysis that connects the political turmoil to the very deepest levels of cultural breakdown.
And to transition from there, we move from the crisis of individual moral agency to the crisis of individual cognitive agency.
Which brings us to another profound societal shift driven by technology, the arrival of artificial intelligence in education.
Detailed by Frederick M. Hess in AI Goes to School.
And the initial reaction from education leaders is one of profound, uncritical enthusiasm.
Oh, absolutely. We're seeing these powerful forces, including Secretary Linda McMahon and major philanthropic bodies like the Gates Foundation, championing AI tutoring.
They're promising that students will be able to pursue personalized learning journeys and see up to a 5x increase in student learning outcomes.
All while supposedly moving students away from tedious binary right or wrong thinking.
And the irony that Hess highlights here is truly astounding.
It is. How can we be so enthusiastic about new technology when, at this very moment, schools across the country are scrambling desperately to combat the toxic influence of the last major educational technology, the cell phone?
Exactly. Cell phones became engines of distraction, which led directly to the academic decline that Harvard's Martin West theory links to the rise of smartphones in the early 2010s.
It's a classic case of failing to learn from the immediate past.
I mean, rewind 15 years, and the predictions about technology in the classroom were equally naive and glowing.
Right. Groups like Edutopia and Fast Company were touting the revolutionary power of the iPhone and the iPad, believing students would be too engaged with blended learning models to play games.
They assured parents and teachers that mere facts were unimportant because students could just look anything up on Google.
But the actual result of all that enthusiasm was academic decline and social pathology.
Precisely. Cell phones provided 247 access to distractions, gossip, cyberbullying, pornography, gaming right in the classroom.
A Common Sense report found that 97% of students aged 11 to 17 checked their phones during the school day, often picking them up more than a dozen times.
And in the rush to be modern, schools scrapped textbooks, they failed to maintain academic rigor, and they drove everything onto digital platforms, making it almost impossible for parents to limit screen time at home.
So the technology was not an amplifier of knowledge. It was an amplifier of distraction and social dysfunction.
So, if we accept this historical lesson, how do educators navigate the path forward with AI without repeating the smartphone failure on a potentially even grander scale?
Well, Hess proposes four specific practical guideposts. A path of cautious wisdom.
And the first guidepost is a firm rejection of the past decade's intellectual trend.
Knowledge is vital. Hess argues that this notion that mere facts are past is dangerously wrong.
Facts are more important than ever in a world flooded with deepfakes and what he calls large language model, LLM, hallucinations.
Right. The sophisticated yet often false or fabricated output that's generated by AI systems like ChatGPT. Students have to have a robust factual foundation in history, civics, and science to distinguish reality from machine-generated fiction.
And the second guidepost, it concerns the relationship between AI and human effort, which speaks directly to that crisis of individual cognitive agency we were talking about.
This is all about avoiding atrophy. Hess insists AI must be an amplifier, not a substitute.
As technology expert Alex Cotron warned, outsourcing hard, essential work to LLMs like having the AI summarize complex texts or draft essays, it leads to the atrophy of a student's core writing and thinking muscles.
Right. Reflexive mastery, the ability to think independently and articulate complex ideas, it requires deliberate, sometimes tedious repetition and struggle. And if students are deprived of that effort by leaning on AI, they will lose the fundamental capacity to generate original thought.
The third is a necessary reminder about the human element.
Yes. Hess stresses the fundamental human need for connection. No matter how sophisticated or personalized AI tutors become, they cannot replace the human element of teaching and mentorship.
The prior diet of small screens and constant digital interaction has already left youth severely lonely, anxious, and alienated.
An AI companion, no matter how emotionally compelling its illusion, cannot provide the wisdom, the empathy, or the reassuring human hand on the shoulder that a struggling student needs.
And finally, Hess emphasizes parental control and choice.
School policies regarding AI use, they inevitably have massive ripple effects. If schools routinize student interaction with AI companions and require their use for homework, it inherently limits the ability of families to make crucial, informed decisions about when and how their children use these tools at home.
This isn't just a technical decision, it's a matter of parental judgment and wisdom.
And those are things that cannot and should not be delegated to an algorithm.
Learning from past technological mistakes is crucial. And that theme, the importance of wisdom and avoiding predictable social pathologies, is essential when we're addressing new vulnerabilities in American life.
Like the corrupt culture of legalized sports gambling that Andrew C. McCarthy addresses in Confidence Game.
McCarthy's piece is a sobering look at how a change in the law unleashed massive pathology.
He starts with this chilling observation based on the logic of organized crime, exemplified by the mobster Henry Hill. Superior performance is uncertain, but underperformance is a cinch for rigging.
That's a chilling way to put it.
And that logic, McCarthy argues, has returned with a vengeance since the 2018 Supreme Court ruling that invalidated the Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act, or PASPA.
Which had long restricted sports betting nationwide.
Right.
So the invalidation of PASPA unleashed a fire hose of legalized online wagering. What are the numbers showing?
The rise has been meteoric. We saw nearly $150 billion in wagers generated last year. But the critical shift is how the betting occurs. The focus moved away from simply betting on a team's final victory or loss to these hyper-specific individual player statistics.
The prop bet.
Exactly. Now, through taps on your phone, you can bet live, minute by minute, on whether a basketball player will score over or under a certain point total, or whether a pitcher will throw a specific number of balls outside the strike zone during a particular inning.
And this just creates a wide open opportunity for the modern equivalent of insider trading.
Absolutely. We are seeing a cascade of high-profile scandals, all relying on willful underperformance and insider intelligence, which just validates Henry Hill's logic.
The most prominent example is Jonte Porter of the NBA, who was banned for life.
Right. He actively bet on his own underperformance, alerting co-conspirators that he would limit his playing time and exit games early due to fake injuries.
We also saw Terry Rozier, a shooting guard, pull himself out of a game after just 9 minutes,
ensuring a winning underbet for his associates.
But the most brazen examples involve controlling these tiny microactions, which is only possible with real-time phone betting.
Precisely. Consider the cases of the Cleveland Guardians pitchers, Clase and Ortiz. They are accused of coordinating with bettors, intentionally throwing pitches outside the zone at agreed-upon times.
Which allows associates to place real-time prop bets with certainty moments before the pitch is even delivered.
This ability to bet on minute actions instantly is what transforms the sport from a contest of skill into a rigged market manipulation scheme.
And beyond the corruption, McCarthy stresses the massive social pathology this legalized gambling has created.
It's devastating. The surge has hooked oceans of bettors, moving far beyond the traditional hardcore that was associated with illegal gambling.
The ease of online real-time wagering, often starting at just a few dollars, has led to rampant pathology.
Addiction, substance abuse, depression, and financial ruin, particularly among the young who often don't grasp the peril.
And the worst part is that the leagues themselves, having entered these devil's packs with sports books for massive revenue streams,
they are financially incentivized to look the other way, even as the integrity of their own product is actively sullied.
Speaking of things that present both a policy challenge and a social headache, let's transition to public health and lifestyle choices.
Charles C.W. Cook writes about legalized marijuana in Deep in the Weed, detailing the complex trade-offs.
Cook is a strong classical liberal, so he reiterates the principled case for legalization.
Right. The federal government lacks the enumerated power to regulate drugs. Prohibition was a massive failure that disproportionately targeted minorities. And fundamentally, government shouldn't superintend consumption in an otherwise free society.
And he still believes all those core principles hold true.
He does. Yet the annoying reality of legalization has made him, in his words, a squishy agnostic on the matter.
What practical consequence has soured his principled position?
It's the pervasive, ubiquitous, and deeply unpleasant smell of skunk everywhere in major cities.
He notes that walking through New York, Chicago, or San Francisco has become actively unpleasant, with the stench constantly wafting through parks, public squares, and even open-air restaurants.
Cook argues that the loss of atmospheric pleasantness is a huge cost to civil society that voters didn't sign up for.
But wait, if legalization is the problem, how is the smell not an inevitable consequence? Where is this strategic blunder in policy?
The blunder is the absurdity of enforcement, or rather, the lack thereof. This is the strategic failing of progressive governance.
In almost every major U.S. city, public alcohol consumption is strictly illegal and enforced.
Yet public weed use is implicitly or explicitly tolerated. Cook makes the analogy. If a commercial laundromat consistently pumped out a pervasive, disruptive, bad smell onto a bustling street, it would be shut down.
Civil society requires a rigorous observation of the difference between private behavior, what you do in your own home, and public behavior, which affects everyone else's quality of life.
The lesson, then, is that the government achieved limited government by stopping the superintendence of private pot smokers, but failed entirely to protect the public from being dominated by them.
Exactly. Cook suggests that if this perpetual cloud of pervasive smoke continues, citizens will regret their decision to legalize, citing the example of Florida voters who rejected a legalization measure precisely because Governor Ron DeSantis warned that the state would start to smell like marijuana.
The core issue is that progressives struggle to distinguish between what is legally permissible and what is socially good or appropriate. Marijuana, like a Yoko Ono coffee table book, is fine to enjoy, but best indulged in private.
Moving from one substance debate to another, Andrew Studdiford discusses the new anti-drinking agenda in Temperance on Tap, a resurgence of modern neo-prohibitionism.
This modern temperance movement, unlike the historical one, is driven primarily by an expansive view of alcohol's externalities.
Meaning the cost imposed on non-drinkers.
Right. They're effectively adopting the playbook used in the tobacco wars, where concerns about passive smoking undermine the argument for individual autonomy. They are focusing on what you might call passive drinking costs.
And the cost calculation is central to their moral argument for higher taxes and restrictions.
It is. The CDC assessed the overall costs of excessive drinking at a massive $250 billion annually.
And the crucial data point is that 3/4 of that figure, they claim, arises from lost labor and lower worker performance.
Which justifies a highly invasive view. All Americans are essentially cogs in an economic machine, and drinking reduces efficiency.
And then they calculate the average per capita, direct and indirect costs paid by every American, regardless of their drinking habits.
And that serves as the political argument for higher taxes and minimum pricing to defray costs supposedly heaped on the non-soused.
The health claims supporting this agenda are also becoming far more absolute, aren't they?
Yes. The scientific consensus, or at least the public health messaging, is shifting dramatically toward total abstinence. In January 2023, the World Health Organization, the WHO, stated there is no detectable threshold for alcohol's carcinogenic effect.
Declaring risk start from the first drop.
From the first drop. Furthermore, Surgeon General Murthy, in his departing report, listed alcohol as the third leading preventable cause of cancer and aggressively pushed for mandatory cancer warning labels on all bottles, similar to those on cigarette packaging.
But the magazine notes that this absolutist stance is not entirely settled within government scientific circles.
And that's a key point of contention. The National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine, or NASEM, concluded that moderate drinking is actually associated with lower all-cause mortality, particularly cardiovascular benefits.
Which directly contradicted a report issued by another group, the ICCPE.
The International Council on Clean and Profitable Utility Development, yeah. They were accused of advancing a predetermined temperance agenda. The political tilt here is undeniable.
This movement draws strong support from the progressive left's sympathy for the nanny state.
And its tendency to caricature big booze as an easily villainized capitalist industry.
As we discuss these domestic health alarms and policy debates, we have to contrast them with shifting global alarms, specifically those related to climate change.
The rhetoric seems to be shifting toward realism, even from major figures like Bill Gates.
The magazine highlights a significant concession from Gates. He has finally acknowledged the widely known but politically sensitive truth. The Paris Agreement target of confining the global temperature increase to 1.5 degrees Celsius by 2050 is unachievable.
And more importantly, he stated that the likely 2 to 3 degrees Celsius rise by 2100, while serious, is not an existential threat to humanity.
And this realistic outlook means Gates is wisely shifting his massive financial focus toward climate adaptation, protecting vulnerable populations and infrastructure,
rather than solely chasing unattainable mitigation goals.
Yet this realistic perspective contrasts sharply with the bureaucratic response to climate neuroses, particularly in the UK.
Oh, we see a failure of intellectual leadership there. The UK Health Security Agency released a report identifying climate anxiety as a massive driver of mental health problems among youth.
Coining terms like eco-anxiety and solastalgia.
A sense of distress caused by environmental change, yeah. But instead of recommending measures to reduce the apocalyptic rhetoric that feeds this dread, the bureaucratic fix is to create climate cafes and incorporate yoga into the curriculum.
Which sort of validates the alarmism as a reasonable response.
It essentially institutionalizes and reinforces paranoid delusions rather than calmly addressing the risk.
That distinction, the difference between realistic threat assessment and validated alarmism, is a perfect segue into high-stakes global threats in geopolitics.
Let's move to the Western Hemisphere and Seth Cropsey's urgent warning in the threat from Venezuela.
Cropsey, a former naval officer with deep strategic experience, identifies Venezuela as the lone U.S. adversary in the Western Hemisphere that possesses these deep, coordinated strategic partnerships across the world.
This is not some isolated rogue state. It is a key financial backer of China and receives crucial military and intelligence support from Russia, Cuba, and North Korea.
And Nicolas Maduro literally survives because of mercenaries backed by the Russian Wagner Group.
And the omnipresent Cuban intelligence officers who staff his security apparatus.
So why is Venezuela's strategic importance so high beyond just the ideology.
Its location makes it a critical nexus for destabilizing the hemisphere and projecting hostile influence. It's key to drug smuggling, facilitating the transfer of Colombian cocaine to the U.S. market.
And it allows hostile actors, particularly Iran and its proxies, to launder dirty money through the region.
Critically, its influence allows these actors to expand power into Colombia and threaten U.S. interests in the Caribbean shipping lanes, which are vital for global commerce.
The Trump administration has taken action, including deploying an amphibious task force and carrying out 20 strikes against suspected drug boats since September.
But Cropsey argues the U.S. is still trapped by these constraining paradigms.
So what does he prescribe to truly eliminate the threat?
Cropsey is exceptionally hawkish. He argues that the administration has to move beyond containment
to eliminate the long-term threat and prevent the country from becoming a permanent hostile base.
The administration must destroy the Maduro regime's entire elite cadre. This includes hundreds of military officers and high-level functionaries who benefit financially and politically from the corruption.
He warns that anything less than total destruction of the leadership structure means the regime will just reconstitute itself quickly,
leading to continued instability and potentially generating a massive refugee crisis that strains neighboring countries.
This sounds incredibly controversial, but Cropsey connects this aggressive action to historical necessity.
He does. He argues that the conventional wisdom regarding the U.S. victory in the Cold War often ignores the crucial component of securing Latin America.
Ronald Reagan didn't just win through macroeconomic policy. He took decisive military action in Grenada in 1983.
Cropsey insists that specific local decisions like these, securing the hemisphere from hostile influence, were essential to the Cold War's outcome. He notes that the U.S.'s asymmetric advantage in the Western Hemisphere is its size and proximity.
China and Russia cannot support Venezuela indefinitely in a confrontation without running extraordinary strategic risks.
So Cropsey concludes that James Monroe's 1823 admonition that hostile nations meddling in the hemisphere is dangerous to our peace and safety is entirely applicable today and justifies decisive action.
From the Western Hemisphere, let's look eastward to Jim Garrity's analysis of U.S.-India relations in Our Indian Partner, But Not Our Ally.
And Garrity found the relationship stuck in a rough patch, despite shared democratic ideals and mutual security concerns regarding China.
The partnership faces a fundamental, almost semantic challenge.
It does. India has an ingrained historical resistance to the term alliance because it infers unwanted obligations and a painful loss of sovereignty, which is rooted in their colonial past. They firmly prefer the term partnership.
And this independence means they consistently resist U.S. pressure, particularly on trade and geopolitical maneuvering.
The trade tensions with the Trump administration are certainly not helping to ease this diplomatic friction.
No, they absolutely are not. India vigorously resisted Trump's 25% retaliatory tariffs. Modi's economic advisor emphasized to Garrity that India would not accept low tariffs as a symbolic tribute, as perhaps Europe had done.
They're insisting they are firm about standing their ground on trade parity. Furthermore, while Prime Minister Modi respects Trump, he faces this massive domestic constraint.
He can never appear deferential to the American president.
Right, because of the Indian electorate's extreme sensitivity regarding the legacy of colonialism and foreign dominance.
Then there is the persistent issue that complicates India's relationship with the West, their Putin blind spot.
This is a complex mix of old Cold War ties and new economic necessity. India sees Russia as a tried and tested friend from the Soviet era.
With the added benefit of being a partner that imposes no demands in return, unlike the U.S., which often links trade to human rights or geopolitical alignment.
Economically, India bought $238 billion in Russian oil and coal since the 2022 invasion of Ukraine.
And while U.S. sanctions finally caused a pause in some Russian oil orders in November, Indian experts warned Garrity that Modi will likely continue to play footsie with Putin.
Because they simply do not have a transactional quid pro quo view toward their established partners. This commitment to non-alignment was visually confirmed when Modi attended a major military parade in Beijing alongside Putin and North Korea's Kim Jong-un.
And nothing infuriates Indian policymakers more than Trump's handling of the Pakistan problem.
It is a profound irritant. Trump's recent praise for Pakistani Field Marshal Syed Asim Munir, calling him incredibly my favorite field marshal,
infuriates Indian policymakers who view Munir as an existential threat and an unapologetic jihadist focused entirely on undermining India.
And Trump also exaggerated his role, claiming he personally ended the brief May conflict between the nuclear-armed rivals.
This claim alone irks the broad swath of Indians who loathe any notion of an outside force imposing a peace plan or acting as a mediator in their regional disputes.
So Garrity concludes that American policymakers need a dose of realism here.
Yes. His takeaway is that India, for a very long time, long before the U.S. existed, has done its own thing.
And policymakers need to accept that the partnership will inherently have some good days and some bad days. The U.S. has to value India as a counterweight to China, even if India refuses to be an alliance puppet.
Transitioning to the Middle East, we find Michael M. Rosen and Daniel Rosen's deeply moving report, Renewal in Israel.
It offers stories of hope and resilience 2 years after the October 7th invasion.
The report details the emotionally significant closure following the release of the last 20 living American-Israeli hostages in October 2025.
Negotiated under a Trump administration's ceasefire deal. Critically, this agreement also included the return of the remains of Omer Neutra and Itay Chen, American-Israeli lone soldiers killed in battle.
And for the families, this return provided a vital step toward healing.
The stories of recovery they detail highlight profound personal resilience.
Take the musician Alon Ola, who was seized at the Nova Music Festival. After a horrific 2-year ordeal, he returned, recovered from necessary eye surgery,
and found a way to survive the tunnels by focusing on life beyond the tunnels. His story of returning to normalcy included joining the cast of Israel's Saturday Night Live equivalent, playing piano, a small but powerful symbol of national healing.
And the Dekel Chen family illustrates the painful compromises required for future safety.
Their son Sagji was abducted while bravely defending kibbutz near Oz. The family rejoices that Sagji, his wife, and children, including one born while he was held in Gaza, are reunited, relying on countless small miracles for their recovery.
However, the report highlights that Sagji and other young families are making the difficult choice to relocate to a new kibbutz far from the border.
Acknowledging that near Oz, the community they defended, cannot fully return to the vulnerability it knew on October 6th.
What's particularly powerful is the spirit of unity that emerged from the conflict.
The war became an eye-opener for the rest of the country. We see this in Leora Bentzer, who gave birth just 30 hours before October 7th and lost her mother in the attack.
She refused to give up her home in Kibbutz Ayin HaShalosha, declaring it her responsibility to take care of the Otef Aza, the Gaza envelope region.
And this personal determination fueled a larger structural response.
That structural response led to the establishment of a very unique civil society organization.
Yes, the establishment of Brit HaNegev VeHar, or the Covenant of the Negev and the Mountain. This initiative was specifically designed to bridge ideological gaps between right-wing religious communities and left-wing secular ones that had been widening before the war.
And the catalyst was the sacrifice of heroes like Elkanan Kalmanson.
There is a deep, abiding sense of gratitude for the thousands of citizens who immediately jumped in to help following October 7th, recognizing that the conflict, if ignored, would eventually reach everyone. This determination to rebuild, rooted in a renewed sense of shared mission, is vital for the country's economic and moral future.
Moving now to culture and American icons, Peter Tungett reviews Sean Levy's biography, Clint, The Man in the Movies, focusing on what he calls the Eastwood Enigma.
Tungett notes that Levy is a fair-minded journalist who acknowledges Eastwood's craftsmanship and enduring stardom.
But he expresses utter mystification regarding Eastwood's specific politics, especially his ostentatiously right-wing films.
Right. Levy is perfectly happy to echo decades-old academic criticisms, calling the hero of Dirty Harry indisputably a bloodthirsty sadist, and dismissing the Cold War thriller Firefox as nothing more than jingoistic and self-righteous.
So the biographer appreciates the craft, but fundamentally rejects the core vision or philosophy embedded in Eastwood's most characteristic works.
Precisely. Levy praises films with inarguable merits, like the Oscar-winning Unforgiven, or those where Eastwood expresses self-doubt or atonement, like Gran Torino.
But when Eastwood is most strident about his deep libertarian convictions, as in Sudden Impact, which Levy summarizes as a relentless tale of rape, misogyny, summary execution, vengeance, contempt for social change and legal praxis.
Levy lashes out, viewing the films not as character explorations, but as political screeds.
And this highlights Eastwood's distinct libertarian values and his famously minimalist directorial philosophy.
That philosophy is crucial to understanding the Enigma, Eastwood learned early on to prune extraneous dialogue, guided by the belief that the more a character says, the more it takes away from the image of decisiveness, of control.
He consciously adopted the brisk, focused, masculine demeanor of his mentor, director Don Siegel.
Tungett suggests that Levy's profound discomfort with Eastwood's most characteristic, politically charged films indicates a significant intellectual gap. He argues that a truly insightful biography of Eastwood requires someone who better shares or at least understands the star's persistent libertarian right instincts rather than viewing them with perpetual mystification.
From figures of executive presence to the actual exercise of executive power, let's look at the magazine's review of clemency, pardons, and presidential actions under both the Trump and Biden administrations.
Starting with Joe Biden's clemency record.
The Republican-led House Oversight Committee released a report confirming serious procedural issues. Joe Biden's staff repeatedly used an autopen to sign numerous pardons and commutations, particularly during the final phase of his term.
And the pardoned individuals included family members and the thrice-murdering Black Widow killer.
The report suggests this method was used as part of a campaign to set a clemency record while simultaneously hiding the extent of the senescent president's alleged mental decline from the American public.
So the concern is the delegation of a core executive function, the act of mercy to staff, potentially compromising the legitimacy of the act itself.
Shifting to Donald Trump, he used his power of clemency to pardon 2020 campaign advisors and supporters who were complicit in the fake elector schemes.
And while critics portrayed this as a blatant obstruction of justice, the magazine offered a more measured analysis.
They argue that the pardons, while often misleadingly portrayed as prospective or covering vast crimes, were less objectionable than critics claimed.
Right. This is because the underlying federal allegations regarding the elector schemes were often weak based on complex legal interpretations, and the statute of limitations was about to expire anyway.
So the pardons excused no federal crimes that were ever likely to be successfully charged, and they had zero effect on state charges that, at the time of the magazine's publishing, appeared to be collapsing under legal scrutiny.
However, the magazine sternly notes that the action does continue Trump's condemnable obsession with portraying the 2020 victory as a fraud, undermining faith in democratic processes.
And finally, Trump's ambitious and highly criticized architectural plans for the White House East Wing.
Trump initiated the demolition of a handful of 1940s-era office buildings to replace them with a sprawling $250 million ballroom and entertainment space.
And the reaction from critics like California Governor Gavin Newsom and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was
morose and hysterical rhetoric, complaining that Trump was literally destroying the White House.
The magazine counters this critique by pointing out that it is arguably the silliest reason to criticize him.
Objectively, the White House has long lacked sufficiently robust entertainment spaces for large state functions, and this idea is far from unprecedented.
President Benjamin Harrison first proposed such an addition in 1891.
So, altering a modern, non-historic part of the headquarters is not destroying the White House, it's addressing a long-standing functional need.
Now, wrapping up our cultural section with a personal, profoundly relatable note, the intense, almost spiritual relationship fans maintain with cultural icons.
Highlighted by James Rosen's piece, Knowing That Love Is to Share.
Rosen recounts his profound, almost clumsy encounter with Sir Paul McCartney 20 years ago during a taping of the SiriusXM show Artist Confidential.
Rosen was one of the few fans invited on stage, and he was so overwhelmed by the proximity to a living legend that his wife had to issue an urgent warning, keep your shud together.
And he recounts this specific moment. McCartney, using his distinctive Scouse accent, guided Rosen's hand to the piano keys and instructed him to play just two keys repeatedly.
Ching, 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 ching.
Despite the simplicity of the task and initially missing the rhythm, Rosen describes achieving a fleeting Fab Meta experience, willing himself into a genuine, if minimal, studio session with a Beatle.
The sheer intensity of the moment meant that this small, two-key role where he was warned not to get above your station remains one of the most important, profound memories of his life.
It speaks to the enduring personal connection fans feel to these figures who shape generations of culture.
The issue also touches on smaller but significant cultural shifts, such as the magazine's eulogy for coinage.
Right. Rob Long, in Athwart, notes that Trump abolished the penny.
Long humorously points out that the penny, which he calls the coinage equivalent of lint, will be missed mainly because its demise signals a broader societal shift.
A move away from physical currency toward entirely digital money.
Long, ever the contrarian, suggests that having relegated a great man Lincoln to the lowest coin, the government should melt down the 98 trillion remaining pennies and cast an enormous 20-story colossus of Lincoln to rectify the historical insult.
And speaking of things that provide a feeling of timeless freedom, Luther Ray Abel writes about becoming a novice motorcycle rider in Rubberside Down,
detailing the rigorous experience of learning to ride in Harley Davidson's backyard.
Abel emphasizes the almost puritanical nature of riding instruction, a great deal of precise shall and shall nots.
He notes the tight historical connection between American military veterans and motorcycling, which provides not only an adrenaline fix, but also the intense feeling of freedom to see the country they defended.
He details the two-day course, where the motto is, "Ride as if you're invisible," learning the necessary defensive caution required on the open road.
His final experience, despite the mechanical failures and freezing weather he faced on his ancient 1977 Honda Goldwing, was sublime. Two legs, two wheels, the wind pounding against his chest.
A timeless, exultant feeling of freedom, even when temporarily stranded by a sputtering engine.
Abel concludes that riding is every bit as dangerous as your grandmother fears, but by golly, is it every bit as glorious as Midair McQueen made it seem.
It's an embrace of inherent risk in exchange for profound, visceral autonomy.
So we have synthesized political identity crises, the breakdown of social morality, the risks of unchecked technology, and high-stakes geopolitics.
What is the overarching theme that connects these massive, seemingly disparate pieces in the January 2026 National Review?
If we connect all these threads, I think the overarching theme is the urgent question of moral agency.
Whether the individual or the system is the primary moral agent deserving of our attention, loyalty, and protection.
We saw this explicitly in the political identity debates, didn't we? Where the GOP struggles to define itself by enduring principles rather than by the personal brand of an individual leader.
And we saw it fundamentally in Typhoor Gang's argument about neo-pagan morality, which dictates that individuals are merely representations of abstractions, justifying violence against them if they symbolize the wrong deity or system.
That's the ultimate rejection of individual agency.
The same tension was present in the corruption of sports gambling, where systemic shifts allowed individual players to willfully underperform for financial gain, eroding the integrity of the individual competitive spirit.
And the debate over AI in schools is exactly about this individual agency. Should we allow LLMs to cause the atrophy of the individual student's writing muscles, replacing effort with automated output?
The deep dive must close by asking you, the listener, to consider Fort Gang's warning. If society loses the ability to articulate or defend the biblical moral basis that recognizes individual dignity, that you are judged by your unique actions, not by what group or abstraction you symbolize.
Society risks a dangerous collapse of social trust, making community and cooperation impossible. The urgency of deciding on those boundaries, whether in politics, culture, or morality, is paramount.
The magazine, as always, included poignant notices of lives concluded, reminding us that knowledge must be applied while we are here. Richard Dick Cheney, a massive figure who lived a full life serving the country, died at 84.
Leaving a legacy that will be intensely debated, from the successful weakening of Al-Qaeda to the deeply unpopular Iraq War, eventually falling out of favor with his own party.
And the remarkable life of David Price Jones, who died at 89, a prolific novelist and historian who wrote for the magazine and embodied a clear-headed, informed conservatism throughout his long career.
Considering the fate of a person, a party, or a nation, we have to ask ourselves, what knowledge, what core principles, what moral basis for individual dignity is most valuable to transmit and apply for lasting liberty?
That's something for you to mull over and perhaps explore further in your own reading.
Until next time.
We'll see you for the next deep dive.